I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're keeping an eye on the BP well in the Gulf and on Washington, where confirmation hearings begin for Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan. But we want to begin today with a look at the Bush tax cuts. Now, they don't expire until December, but the battle has been fully engaged. This morning, U.S. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner on ABC's Good Morning America made the argument for President Obama's proposal, which is to extend only the portion of the tax breaks that go to middle Americans.
We're proposing to extend tax cuts that go to more than 95% of working Americans, more than 95% of small businesses across the country. We also think it makes sense to let those tax cuts that only go to 2% of the highest earning Americans in the country to expire as scheduled.
But Republicans are demanding that all the cuts be extended, including those for the very wealthy. Although in ads like this one, they only mention that the cuts are set to expire, without mentioning the Obama plan to save cuts for the middle class. Here's Fred Thompson for RenewTheTaxCuts.com.
Folks, America's economy is struggling, and Congress is about to make it a whole lot worse. Our nation faces a massive automatic tax increase at the end of this year when the Bush tax cuts expire. When that happens, your income taxes could increase by 10% or more. Capital gains taxes will jump over 30%. Taxes on dividends will more than double.
Well, not all Republicans are walking in lockstep, as we're going to hear in a few minutes, because it's estimated that extending the tax cuts to all will add between $3 and $4 trillion to the deficit. But here's House Minority Leader John Boehner responding to Fox's Chris Wallace on that topic.
But Congressman, what are you going to do about that $3 trillion hole that you're blowing in the deficit by extending all
no
of these taxes?
Let me just finish
the question. $3 trillion deficit that you're blowing in the deficit, $3 trillion that you're blowing in the deficit by extending the tax cuts.
Why can't we keep tax rates where they are today?
So, as former Labor Secretary Robert Reich said last night on MSNBC, Republicans are willing to block unemployment insurance, money for teachers, but it's okay to extend tax cuts to the top 2% of Americans. Let's take a closer look with Howard Gleckman, resident fellow at the Urban Institute and editor of Tax Vox for the Tax Policy Center. That's a joint venture of the Urban Institute and the Brookings Institution. They've weighed in on this, and we're going to hear their thinking as well. But Howard, first of all, Republicans pushing to raise the deficit. What's going on here? You've called this a game of political chicken.
Oh, Robin, it's great to be with you. And that's exactly right. This is the tired old argument we've been having for decades now, really since the Reagan administration, about raising taxes or not raising taxes. You did it. No, you didn't do it. You said it first. And we're already starting to get warmed up. The Congress isn't going to really focus on this until September, but everybody's kind of getting going here. And that's exactly right. There are two questions. One of them is, do we want to cut taxes for everyone? Particularly, do we want to do it for the very wealthy?
Which would be extending the tax cuts.
Exactly. Or do we want to do something about the deficit? We say we want to do something about the deficit, but I don't hear very many people saying they want to give up their tax cut.
But here we have Republicans getting pushback on Fox, you know, being asked about the deficits. And someone would think that that is dangerous politically, but last night, Robert Reich also said that framing an issue is what's important here. It worked with the estate tax, he says. Last year, Republicans convinced middle Americans that the estate tax would affect them when it only affected the wealthiest Americans. But Republicans were able to reframe it as the death tax. Is framing going on here?
Framing is a big part of this argument. And actually, I would argue that both parties are asking the wrong question. The Democrats have themselves in a bit of a jam when the debate is over whether or not to extend the Bush tax cuts. Because let's face it, no matter what people say about tax cuts or what they say about the deficit, they actually like tax cuts. They don't like the idea of their taxes going up.
Right.
So frankly, the right question ought to be, you know, is the current tax system capable of generating the revenue we need to run the government that we want in the most efficient and fair way possible? That would be a good, productive debate, and that would lead us to some discussion about tax reform. Instead, we're having the same tired old debate about tax cuts.
Well, let's take a look at what analysts say those tax cuts do. Republicans say the money that the Obama administration wants to ask the very wealthy to now take a cut on. Again, let's review because we haven't even said it. Obama wants to keep the tax cuts for individuals making less than $200,000 and families making less than $250,000. So in other words, he would allow the tax cuts for people in upper categories to expire. Republicans say that's money that would be used to pour, by the wealthy to pour back into the economy and help stimulate it. So what do economists say about that?
The general consensus is that in the short run, tax cuts for very wealthy people don't do very much to stimulate the economy. What we need right now is an increase in consumer demand. And in English, we want people to buy more stuff. When you give very wealthy people tax cuts, what they tend to do is save it and invest it. Now, that's very good in the long run, but it's not going to do very much to get our economy out of the short-term doldrums.
I mean, that's what the Congressional Budget Office says the same. They say Bush tax cuts have a small bang for the buck because, as you said, the very rich don't spend their money. We were looking at some of the numbers that people, you know, are trying to illustrate what this tax cut would mean. If you make $2.8 million, good for you, first of all, but that would be something like $370,000 that the cut would save you, and that if the cut expires, you'd now have to pay in taxes, $370,000. But as the CBO says, very wealthy people aren't going to turn around and spend $370,000.
No, that's exactly right. The other long-term problem, and this goes to the other piece of this debate, is if you cut taxes for anybody, but particularly for wealthy people, and you don't pay for them, what that tends to do is, of course, force the government to borrow more money. And because the government is borrowing lots more money, it makes it harder for businesses to borrow money. So unless you pay for those tax cuts somehow, the economic benefit, even in the long run, is somewhat limited. So that's exactly right. It's also important to note when you look at these this whole question about whether to extend the tax cuts or not. If the tax cuts are not extended, if we simply let the pre-2001 law come back into effect, what's going to happen is the average tax increase will be about $1,800. For middle-income families, it'll be about $1,000, and for people making more than $1 million, it'll be $128,000. So as you said, you know, there's a big difference between the benefit to extending the tax cuts for the very, very high earners than there is for ordinary people. It's also worth noting that despite all the rhetoric, there's really nobody out there who is talking about letting the tax cuts expire for everyone. Almost everybody on Capitol Hill, almost every economist you talk to says that in the current economy, it's important to continue these tax cuts at least for the next year or two. The question, the real question, the real long-term question is, what are we going to do after that? But there's no real debate. There's no serious debate about letting these tax cuts expire for ordinary income people. The question is, what do you do for the wealthy?
Well, I should point out that former Fed Chair Alan Greenspan over the weekend said actually that he thinks all the cuts should be let go. And this is someone who, it's a complete turnaround for him. He completely supported tax cuts years ago. And when asked, though, to the point, do they pay for themselves if the very rich are allowed to have a tax cut, he said absolutely not. They don't pay for themselves. So there's one voice there. But there are others who are arguing that the very rich should be allowed to keep their tax cut. One of them is Peter Morici. Writing in the Baltimore Sun, he says economists recognize that highly productive people, if taxed punitively, create less wealth in the U.S., that they'll turn to arcane tax planning or simply move their investments offshore. What about that argument, Howard Gluckman, for keeping the cuts for the very wealthy?
In the 1990s, before President Bush was elected and before these tax cuts were enacted, we had an absolutely booming economy, and we had them with relatively high tax rates. You know, I spend much of my day dealing with tax issues, so I shouldn't probably admit this in public, but the truth is that tax rates have much less impact on economic growth than a lot of people would lead you to believe. There's lots of other issues that affect growth more than taxes do. Productivity, international trade, education. There's a whole range of issues that are more important. Taxes matter on the margin. But again, if you look at the relationship between relatively high tax rates and economic growth, it's random. There's no evidence that high taxes retard economic growth, and there's no evidence that low taxes expand the economy. It happens almost randomly. There's too much else going on in the economy. So Peter's argument is awfully simplistic for an academic economist.
That's Howard Gleckman, a resident fellow at the Urban Institute and also with the Tax Policy Center. And we should say that although the Tax Policy Center, Howard, is nonpartisan, they have a position on this issue. Your bosses testified before the Senate Finance Committee saying pretty much what you're saying. But what was fascinating to us is that over the weekend, we also heard from, I guess you could call him the original Reagan-era supply-sider, David Stockman, who wrote a scathing op-ed in the Times saying that the Republican push to extend the tax cuts to the very rich is unseemly, not just a mockery of traditional party ideals, but something that's led to serial financial bubbles and Wall Street depredations that crippled our economy. Ouch. So given that, again, I mean, this is someone who helped invent this thinking of supply side, now, you know, scolding his party. But we see Republicans, you know, going out maybe on a, are they going out on a limb in demanding this or what?
The political calculation here is really interesting. Republicans have been saying on one hand that we need to do something about the deficit. They talk about how President Obama has been utterly irresponsible in increasing the deficit, and they've got an argument. But they also make the argument that taxes ought to be as low as possible. And you can't do both of those things unless you're willing to make dramatic, draconian cuts in government spending. And I await any politician, with the exception of Paul Ryan and a couple of others, I await them to tell me exactly what government spending programs is they want to cut in order to fund these huge tax cuts. You know, you've got three things to do. You've got to cut government spending, you've got to cut taxes, and you've got to balance the budget. Well, how are you going to do it? And that's where the Republicans have, in fact, failed to set out a coherent message. It's also where the Democrats, frankly, have failed to make their case, because they're stuck in this situation where they say all we have to do is raise taxes on rich people and we can deal with the deficit. And that's not true either.
Well, it's funny you mention that, because this week on CNN I saw an entire report on the Bush-era tax cuts, and it made no mention of Obama's plan to keep the cuts in place for the middle class, to only raise taxes, if you will, on the very wealthy. So somehow that message isn't getting out. But we're wondering if, in fact, there's been a turn. People are talking about hearing tougher language from President Obama. A Wall Street Journal poll shows 62% of Americans don't favor returning to Bush economics. Has this given Obama an opportunity to remind people of the Bush era just by saying Bush tax cuts? And we just have a few seconds for your thoughts on that.
I think it does. There was an old aphorism by a former chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, Russell Long. He used to say, "Don't tax me, don't tax the tax that fellow behind the tree," and the fellow behind the tree is rich people. So it may work. There are more middle class people than there are rich people. So maybe it will work.
Howard Gleckman, again of the Urban Institute and the Tax Policy Center, a joint venture of the Urban Institute and Brookings Institution, taking a look at the Bush tax cuts, which are set to expire in December, and the debate that's ignited over it. Howard, thanks as always.
Great to be with you, Rob.
Okay, when we come back, we're going to turn our attention to Arizona. Did the laws there work in that immigrants are leaving the state, illegal immigrants? That's in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. What's been the impact of Arizona's watered-down immigration law? And what's been the reaction to a move to create a new law to override the Constitution and deny children of illegal immigrants who are born in the U.S. their citizenship? Well, first, let's take the immigration law that went into effect last week. The state demographer says it's impossible to know how many immigrants are leaving because of the law. But since it was passed back in April, some Hispanic patients aren't showing up for regular appointments at healthcare clinics. Enrollment at heavily Hispanic schools is dropping, and church congregations are just a little thinner. Father John Herman is pastor of St. John Vianney Catholic Church in Goodyear, Arizona, just west of Phoenix. Father, welcome.
Thank you very much, Robin.
And what are you seeing at your parish as far as people leaving?
Well, since this law has passed, we've noticed an impact on our community in terms of the concerns that the people are bringing to us, the fears that they're expressing. And the economy was bad enough to begin with, and then to add this law on top of it, for a lot of our immigrants, they just felt like enough was enough, so it's time to go. And so after the school year ended in June, we noticed a number of families who left us. I know some personally, and I could just tell a difference in terms of the number of people at our Spanish masses on Sunday. So since the judge's decision to not allow that law to be fully implemented, the impact hasn't been great in terms of people saying, oh, I'm going to stay. It's kind of a wait-and-see thing because they know that even though that decision came through, that it's not the end, that there's going to be more that's going to be coming as a result of all this.
Sure, that decision by the federal judge has been challenged, and we remember that she banned some of the most controversial aspects of the law. For instance, the requirement that local police who have reason to stop someone then also have to ask them about their immigration status. That was knocked aside, as was the requirement that all immigrants carry their documents at all times. But still, you're saying there's sort of a wait-and-see attitude now. And we understand that in churches in particular, there's a way to tell if somebody left out of fear because they often would ask someone like you for a blessing.
Yes, they often do ask for blessings. And some of the people actually as well ask for, in a sense, a letter of recommendation so that when they go to a new church in California or Utah or wherever they might go, that they would go to that church and the priest there or the parish staff there would know that they had been involved in ministries in our parish and that they were worthy or prepared for ministries in the new parish that they would arrive in.
It sounds as if then many of your parishioners who were leaving out of fear, you know, prior to the law being enacted, were not going back home.
No, I don't really know anyone who's going back to Mexico. They were going to other states where they saw other opportunities or where they knew somebody, family or friends. The sense is that things are worse than ever in Mexico, so the better option is to try to go elsewhere to a more immigrant-friendly state.
Well, and then the other question this raises is that you know there are people listening and saying, Father, you're talking about you having an awareness of somebody who's in the country illegally, not waiting for documentation, but not having any, and knowing that they're illegally in the country, and you know too. Is that a sin?
For me to know and to respond to them and their needs,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's a sin because Jesus called us to love one another and to serve those who are most in need, and certainly these people are in great need when they come to us, and so we just do the best that we can to care for their spiritual needs, and there are a whole lot of other people who have the job of enforcing laws and things like that. That's not our position.
Well, what other impacts do you see it having? You have a smaller church congregation, but we're also reading that school districts, one in Phoenix, the Baltz School District, they have five schools there. They lost 111 students since the law was passed. The superintendent says each student represents $5,000 in annual funding, so 111 leaving means $555,000 that they've lost, and we assume this is happening across Arizona.
I believe it is, yes. I know that our local school district is concerned, and our own school in our parish here has lost a number of students to other states. The schools definitely will feel the impact, and I don't think they'll fully realize it until the first day of school when they see how many children actually arrive, yeah. And that's coming very soon.
What about the church? Are you taking a financial hit?
A little bit, but the reality is that a lot of the people who were leaving were pretty poor, so yeah. The financial contributions that they would make were somewhat limited. In many cases, though, the greater contributions that they were making were in other ways in terms of their service and their participation in ministry, so financially, we haven't felt the impact as much as we have in other ways.
Well, and what about this new move? Arizona State Senator Russell Pierce, who was the architect of the immigration law, now says he wants to introduce a new law that would deny birth certificates to babies born to illegal immigrants in the U.S. Now, Senator Lindsey Graham says he'll also try to pursue a change to the Constitution because the 14th Amendment does guarantee citizenship to anyone born in the U.S. And Senator John Kyle of Arizona says he's, you know, going to urge Graham to hold hearings about this possibility. How are your parishioners reacting to this?
Well, I would say it's mixed. There would be some who would be supportive and some who would be very much against this. We are a diverse community here. We have our Hispanic population and we have our Anglo population, and so we do have different perspectives on all of these issues regarding immigration, and I think the response in terms of this proposed change to the Constitution with Amendment 14, I think there would be a mixed response to that.
I'm thinking, too, I'm sure, you know, this is Arizona, but I'm wondering if you have people who were born of other immigrant populations, who came here when the Irish came or when the Italians came, and were children who were the first born in the country and became U.S. citizens?
Well, we do. Definitely we do. And they can be people who, in one way, we might think that they would be sympathetic, but in some ways they're not, because in most cases they came through a legal process. And so they would say, well, my family came legally, and we had to follow the law. And so we might think, well, all immigrants who kind of have a shared bond, but it's not really the case.
Boy, tough time to be a parish priest in Arizona.
It is a very challenging time. There's no doubt it's just so important that we try to stay united in what we hold in common, and that's a whole lot more than the differences that people might have over the whole issue of immigration.
Father John Herman, pastor at St. John Vianney Parish in Goodyear, Arizona. Father, thank you for speaking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you, Robin.
Let's go to Pakistan now. That country's being rocked by man-made violence and a natural disaster. More than 40 people have been killed in Karachi in riots that followed the assassination of a member of parliament who was shot and killed during a funeral ceremony he was attending. Schools and many businesses were closed today, and the streets were littered with burned-out vehicles as security forces tried to regain control of the city that's home to 16 million people. In the meantime, fresh rains in the northwestern part of Pakistan are threatening to unleash more flooding. So far, 1,400 people have died, and relief efforts have been delayed by swamped roads, washed-out bridges, and downed communication lines. Those stranded by the floods are complaining about government inaction, and as the BBC's Orla Guerin reports, there are also concerns that the Taliban might try to capitalize on chaos.
We flew deep into the disaster zone with the army. Below us, we saw a landscape turned muddy brown, fields and homes saturated, crops and communities buried, whole villages swept away. We found the torrent still raging in Madayan, one of the areas worst hit by what some here are calling the flood of the century. We watched local people making a perilous crossing in a metal cage suspended on a wire. In places, the water has consumed everything in its path.
Well, you get a real sense right here of the destructive power of the monsoon rains. This is where the road ends. The concrete has crumpled as if it was paper. And over here, we can see the remains of a bridge that was swept away by the power of the water. Now, this is one of 29 bridges in this area that have been destroyed. The army says communities here have been turned into islands, and some areas still can't be reached.
But close to 30,000 people have been brought to safety. We met some of the latest as they added their names to the list of the displaced. Yasser escaped with his baby son Farhan and five other children, with only the clothes they were wearing.
It rained for 3 days, and the water just kept rising and became a flood. Many people drowned. My cousin fell into the water. We haven't been able to find him.
At a temporary camp, we met Nadia, now a homeless mother of three, alive today because she can swim.
When the water came into the house, we went out with the children. People helped us to carry them, but then the water was up to our necks and we managed to swim out. We didn't care about our lives, we just wanted to save the children.
But could more lives have been saved? Could the authorities have been better prepared? I asked General Rashid Javed, a commander in the area.
Did the authorities fail to prepare properly for this? Because there was some warning.
Yes, warning was there, but then that warning could not be translated into the height of waves which are going to come. The warning was there, but this is unprecedented.
The military may have to battle here on two fronts, rescuing those in need and making sure the Taliban can't take advantage of the chaos to make a comeback. Major General Javed Iqbal believes they will try.
I expect that that's going to be their natural thinking because they would want to find a gap. They're not going to find any. So they're not going to find the opportunity to exploit. We already have the presence. We already have the plans. The troops are everywhere, and we have presence in areas even other than Swat.
For now, the immediate priority is the relief effort. The United Nations says as many as 27,000 people are still waiting for help, and more rain is forecast in the coming days.
That report from the BBC's Orla Guerin in Pakistan. Well, by the way, tomorrow we'll touch down in Iraq with the BBC's correspondent in Baghdad. Even as the U.S. winds down combat operations this month, al-Qaeda attacks continue, and that country's still struggling to form a government 5 months after parliamentary elections. So tomorrow to Iraq. Back in 30 seconds, here and now. Well, you may have been hearing stories lately about law enforcement agents showing up at dairy farms and private food buying clubs in California, Minnesota, Ohio, and Wisconsin. Sometimes they're armed, and they're always demanding the raw milk. Rawsome Foods, a private food club in Venice, California, was one of the places raided. Government officials, guns drawn, confiscated thousands of dollars worth of raw food products and shut the store down. The federal government says raw dairy products are unhealthy, that unpasteurized milk contains bacteria that's sent people to the hospital, and its sale is banned in 22 states. But in 20 other states, raw milk can be had directly from farms or through those buying clubs. Advocates say raw milk can strengthen the immune system, that anything yogurt manufacturers say about good bacteria in yogurt is also true of raw milk. Well, David Gumper's been following this controversy. He's author of The Raw Milk Revolution, Behind America's Emerging War Over Food Rights. So, David, just to be specific, what's the difference between raw milk and the pasteurized milk you buy in the supermarket?
Raw milk is the milk we drink straight from the cow. Pasteurized milk is heat processed. Standard pasteurization involves heating it to 161 degrees for about 10, 15 seconds. And then there's another process called ultra-high temperature pasteurization, where the milk is heated to 275 degrees.
Okay, and some dairy people will point out that's why we can ship milk cross-country, because it's pasteurized, it keeps longer. But critics of pasteurization say it kills not just the bad bacteria, but the good.
It kills the good bacteria, and it kills off a number of enzymes, which are thought to be helpful to good health.
Well, proponents of raw milk also say that it's nutritionally better. Is there scientific evidence for that?
There is some scientific evidence. There's some very interesting research out of Europe. There was a study done of 15,000 children in Europe, overseen by scholars from around the country, including the Harvard Medical School. And the study showed that the children who consumed raw milk had about a 25% lower incidence of asthma and allergies.
Well, critics of that study point out that it's unclear if the protection that those children seem to get comes from the milk or from being exposed to bacteria from animals, you know, that they're closer to the animals. And as you probably heard, Marion Nestle, the nutritionist and food safety expert, told NPR this past weekend that she doesn't think that the science is there. And further, you know, there are critics who say, wait a second, people have gone to the hospital after drinking raw milk.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can debate that kind of thing all you want. What it really calls out for is for more studies. And the question I would ask is, why aren't we studying that issue more in the U.S.?
Well, there are several sources of information. One is realrawmilkfacts.com, and they say dairy products cause about 1% of foodborne outbreaks. About 70% of those are from raw milk or raw cheese. We know raw milk can contain E. coli, salmonella. It's sickened more than 1,000 people since 1998, according to other research, and was blamed for sickening 30 people in Colorado. Two children were sent to the hospital. So we don't see any fatalities as we do with some other food problems. But do we know how many people have gotten sick from raw milk?
Well, I think the best thing to do is look at the CDC data, U.S. Centers for Disease Control, and they provided data recently that covered 33 years from 1973 to 2005. And what that data showed was that there was an average of 54 illnesses reported to the CDC each year. Now, that only accounts for reported illness. You have to figure for each reported illness, there's something on the order of perhaps 20 unreported illnesses. But even if you allow for that, you're looking at maybe 1,000. Now, there definitely has been an uptick this year. And this year, the reports I've seen are something like 9 outbreaks with about 97 people becoming ill. Now, once again, if you multiply that times 20, you're looking at maybe 2,000 illnesses. It's one of the things that's important to remember about all this is that when you look at any particular year, there could be a lot of illnesses. So when you look at that 33-year period I mentioned, some years there were no illnesses reported to the CDC. Some years there were 150 illnesses reported to the CDC.
How does that compare to other foodborne illnesses?
Just by way of comparison, the Food and Drug Administration a couple of years ago put some new regulations on treatment of eggs. They mandated that eggs needed to be refrigerated from pretty much from the time they're laid until the time they get to the store. And they said at the time there was something on the order of 140,000 illnesses from salmonella each year in
140,000.
Eggs. 140,000. They said that the steps they were taking would reduce that number by about 50%.
And again, that's compared to about a 2,000 total in 33 years?
That's compared to about 2,000 total, yes, in 33 years.
For raw milk?
Yes.
Given that, what do you think is behind this uptick in government crackdowns on raw milk clubs?
We don't know the answer for sure because the government really isn't saying. They say that these things are under investigation, but it seems clear there's concern by big dairy interests in what's happening with raw milk, that they are worried about the growing popularity of raw milk and the inroads that it's making in attracting consumers. So there's evidence that big dairy is pressuring the regulators to crack down more on raw milk. We saw one case here in Massachusetts just this year. The regulators have tried to shut down delivery services that bring raw milk from central and western Massachusetts into the urban areas of Boston. And there hasn't been an illness from raw milk in Massachusetts in at least 15 years.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, full disclosure here, do you drink raw milk?
Yes, I do. I've been drinking raw milk for the last 4 years.
But do you at all worry about salmonella, about any of the other bacteria that might be there?
I don't worry because I buy my milk from two farms that I know well, and I know that there hasn't been any illness associated with those farms. I know how the farmers produce the milk. I know they take a lot of care. They're very concerned about sanitation, about the care of the animals.
Well, let's be perfectly blunt. These are animals. Animals don't tend to be very picky about their habits. And, you know, the concern is that there might be fecal matter or, you know, something else having to do with the animal in your milk.
Right. And what I'm doing is I'm trusting the farmers to take a lot of care in the milking process.
Well, so, David, where do you think this fight is headed?
It's obvious that interest and consumption of raw milk is growing quickly. I think it's in part and parcel of a growing trend, growing interest in what we call nutrient-dense foods, eggs from pastured chickens, pastured beef. The demand for these foods is growing as people become more concerned about the factory food system. I just think it's very difficult for the government to stamp this out.
David Gumpert, he's author of The Raw Milk Revolution, Behind America's Emerging War Over Food Rights. David, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Eric Poole had a miserable childhood, listening to his mother rage at his out-of-work dad when she wasn't lemon-pledging the zenith, trying to please her by not leaving footprints on the shag rug. Then there was Grandma, the chain smoker who set the mattress on fire, his sister Val, who Grandma said was turning into a truck stop whore, and any number of school bullies for whom Eric, with his perfect hand motion on the Supremes' Stop in the Name of Love, was a perfect target. One refuge for him, the TV show Bewitched.
I worshipped the TV show Bewitched, and to Mother's irritation could be found flattening the shag in the family room every Thursday night when it aired. The lovely wife, Samantha, her devoted husband, Darren, and their spotless suburban home all mirrored my own family's existence, but with a refreshing lack of screaming and crying. Yet even more alluring was the magic. The notion of being able to snap my fingers, wave my hands, or twinkle my nose and magically alter the circumstances of life was intoxicating, akin to learning voodoo or having Jesus owe you one. And the more I watched, the more I became convinced that somewhere within my own being, I must possess similar magical powers.
In finding his magic, Eric turned an old white bedspread in the basement into his magical robes, making wishes as simple as, "Please, God, let Christmas go well." Oh, and God, how to handle God, When You're Growing Up Gay and Baptist in the 70s. Eric Poole's memoir of his childhood is called Where's My Wand? One Boy's Magical Triumph Over Alienation and Shag Carpeting, and he joins us from Los Angeles. Eric, welcome.
Thank you, Robin. Nice to be here.
Well, boy, let's start at the very beginning where we're introduced first to your mom, just a banshee, overwhelmed by work and keeping a house together. And in your dedication, you mention her. You say, to my beloved and much mellowed mother, who's never let me forget that she loves me, even after reading this book. How does that happen, forgiveness? Because it's some
well,
tough.
Well, I know. When you call her General Patton and Pedal Pushers, you kind of set yourself up for problems. She's great now. She really is. But back then, she was a holy terror. And it's like, you know, I explained to her early on, it's like, I have to paint you as you were then, not as you are now, you know. And she, to her credit, I mean, I have to tell you, when she first read the first few chapters of the book, she called me and she said, you know, friends have advised me to seek cover in the Witness Protection Program. But she's really just been nothing but 1,000% supportive. I mean, she said to me recently, I guess if Leona Helmsley can be the queen of mean, I can be the queen of clean.
Just a little bit about the cleanliness inside and outside in the pool home.
Oh, yeah. Her entire life when she was not at work was spent cleaning. I mean, she ironed everything that had a cotton fill. I mean, down to the tongues of tennis shoes.
Did she really iron the tongues of tennis shoes?
Oh, yeah. It was just like everything had to be perfectly pressed and starched. Like, God bless her. I mean, it was a great, you know, it was great to crawl into a bed that, you know, there was no wrinkles or anything, but it was a little exhausting for her.
Well, and everything had to be good with a capital G. No bad language, no acting out. The whole picture was one of just being
perfect
and repressed. Yeah. And here you are slowly realizing that you're maybe a little different.
That was a bit of a problem, you know, as you can well imagine. You can see why I might have glommed onto something like magic.
Yeah. So tell us about the magic. What were some of the things you put this, was it a chenille bedspread?
Yeah, it was this white thing with fringe on it.
Yeah,
I found it in a closet. And, you know, so when nobody was home, I would, like, sneak down to the basement because, let's face it, this is the last thing I needed anybody to find out. And I would put that bedspread on and close my eyes and wave my arms dramatically, you know, and try to cast these spells to change my life. And, you know, in the beginning, it really seemed to work. There were instances where my mother was kind of a holy terror, and my dad was this really, and still is, this really easygoing guy. And, you know, you can read easygoing sometimes as needs to stand up to her. And so I managed to make him stand up to her in a fairly dramatic way. And I managed to befriend this super cool girl in my class who had no arms. And I was able to make my grandmother and my mother get along, or so I thought. You know, the magic, although it seemed to work, you know, there were times when it kind of didn't come out exactly the way I anticipated it would.
Well, so you first think the magic works, and then you realize that the bedspread has lost its, you know, if it had it at all, it's lost it. And you sort of turn to God, who, again, there's a religion plays a very big role in the home. And you turn to God, and what happens with God?
Well, you know, God became my, because I was, you know, learning in church that magic is a cult, you know, black, it's dark, it's evil. So I had to somehow rationalize this magic that I was doing. And so I thought, well, oh, the magic comes from God. It's like miracles, you know. So that was the way I sort of began to rationalize that it was okay to continue to do my magic.
Well, a little more about that, because you're bullied all the time. There's a bully in the neighborhood who is shooting animals, a little, mm-hmm. little poor little rabbits. And you really are having this crisis of, well, wait
a
second. It
was a crisis of faith. It was really tough to rationalize because it was like I felt abandoned by God. You know what I mean? It was like, hey, wait a minute. My magic's not working anymore. What's going on here? You know, has God abandoned me? Has magic abandoned me? I really couldn't wrap my head around it at that time.
Well, we should say this is all sounding very serious, and it is. I mean, this is important stuff, and everybody can relate to aspects of it. But it's hilarious. Did you feel any of that hilarity when you were a kid?
Yeah, I mean, I did. I think the only way you can get through those things is to try to find some humor in the whole situation. And of course, looking back, you look at it from a different perspective anyway. But you know, I mean, my family was just hilarious. I mean, to me, they were very funny. They didn't particularly think they were funny, but I thought they were hysterical.
So we should note that. But there's one moment, and it just happens, and we move on. Where, I mean, you sort of tell us that you feel you did hear from God.
I had my burning bush moment.
In the basement?
Yeah, yeah.
And so you do embrace a God.
I do. I still do.
You know, I mean, I look at magic now, honestly, as an adult, and I think of it as like two-pronged. You have to believe in yourself and your ability to make things happen, and then I also believe in a God or a universe, whatever you want to think of it as, working with you to make that happen.
Yeah.
You know? Well, God, this all sounds so profound.
I know.
It's really a funny book. But.
It is. Well, any book that has profound thinking and shag carpeting is going to be funny, but we don't want to give away the ending except to say that you were so desperate to overcome this caricature that you had become, you know, the kid that everybody picked on. When you do change that, it involves a trumpet.
Yes. I discovered I had some musical talent, which was great news in our household because there didn't seem to be a lot of talent going around. Mm-hmm. And that becomes my avenue for discovering my place.
So I began, Eric Poole, by saying that you had a miserable childhood. I think that's probably still true. But how did it form you now? I mean, you've got an important job at Fox Television, and, you know, what did it do for you?
Here's an interesting thing. On the plus side, it made me a little bit of a people pleaser, which can be exhausting for me. But it also means I get along well with people. You know, I play nice with others. And it's funny because my mother, as much of a handful as she was also incredibly gracious to people that she liked. I learned a lot by watching her. And so even in the midst of really crappy, unhappy moments in childhood, you can take something positive out of those and turn it into something good.
Do you think that, I mean, this was 69, 70, 71. Do you think young boys are still having this experience of sort of slowly people realizing that maybe they're different, but nobody really talking about it because nobody did and having to make their own way? And
oh, I absolutely do. I mean, you know, in L.A., in New York, in Chicago, you know, maybe not so much. But, I mean, I go home to St. Louis and I see how it's just a different world. It really is.
Mm. Eric Poole, his memoir is Where's My Wand? One Boy's Magical Triumph Over Alienation and Shag Carpeting. Eric, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Robin. It was great to be here.